Vasily Petrenko, what are you most proud of having achieved in your first 3 years as principal conductor of the Royal Liverpool Phil?
The most proud I'm about audience. We achieved 40% growth of audience. And hopefully this habit for the classical music will just increase and increase in Liverpool, with the help from everyone, with the help from local governments, with the help from British government, and the involvement of all good people of Northwest and all the proper scousers as well.
Now, you are in the process of recording all the Shostakovich symphonies, which is a huge project. What's been your relationship with the symphonies, and why do you think they are such an important and unique achievement for our times?
Well, I think that, first of all, they've been in my life since I remember me. They've been played in St. Petersburg and regularly and every year. Even funny enough, they're still being appreciated, most of them, as a contemporary music in Russia. And of course, the top hits like the 5th, 7th, 8th, or 10th, they are well received and well attended. But when you put something less usual, like 12 or 11 or 4.
Really? In Russia?
Yeah, it might scare the audience a little bit.
What?
So, I can remember his music since the very beginning. And to be honest, it's the spirit of Leningrad. It's true spirit of Leningrad.
But it's also a chronicle, isn't it, of Soviet life? That extraordinary.
If talking about the historical context, I'm staying actually on a position about a bit more broad picture about his symphonies, because usually on the West is a lot of attention to the political side of it, while in Soviet Union and in Russia it's been absolutely opposite. The most attention has been about structural side and about the musical side, neglecting the political because it's been not allowed for many, many years. I think, first of all, it's a picture of his life. The whole cycle, in my point of view, is a huge biopic about the life of an artist in the 20th century under the Soviet Union regime. And not only reflecting the political side or historical side, reflecting his own life as well. Family life, relations with other composers, relations with the music society, his relations with some great musicians like Slava Rostropovich, for instance. It's a history of the life of an artist.
See, some of us in the West wonder why he stayed in the Soviet Union when he was subjected to such humiliation on occasions.
Well, first of all, he's been very introverted human himself. He kept silence most of the time. And in fact, the silence quite often meant much more rather than he would say anything.
Yeah.
For him, what was important is to have a wife who will take care about the food and about laundry. To have a room with a table, not necessarily with a silence, but with a working table, like work desk, on which he can write the music. And the piano was not necessary. It's funny enough that the pictures, Shostakovich on the piano composing music, it's not fake picture, it's once upon a time. But he quite never composed on the piano.
Did he compose in full score straight away? Like Mahler?
Yeah. And there are very, very few drafts. And the last thing which he was needed was a hot water in the bathroom.
That's amazing. You said his silence spoke volumes, but also there were lots of coded subtexts in his pieces.
The scripts are famous.
Clearly these were deliberate, these messages he was sending out. Did he really expect audiences to decipher them and understand what he was trying to say, do you think?
I think he tried to write the pieces for the broad range of the classes and all broad range of the intellectuals. Mm. The first symphony, of course, it's a conservatoire finishing work, and that's what he had been written for a year. Then second and third symphony, he felt like he failed because it's been commissioned works for industrial concerts And then came the fourth symphony, which been kind of laboratory in many ways. And that has links to most of the pieces.
Yes.
Later on.
Absolutely.
And then he found this style from the fifth, when he'd been able to put the music into the earth of the proletariat, basically. And in the same time, he'd been able to encode some things for the very little amount of his friends. And for the intellectuals who knows this or that, he tried to speak from his heart most of the time. But because of the restrictions in what he could say, sometime it seems to me that he stopped himself of saying it openly, because otherwise he could have much bigger troubles. And he just encrypt them and put the things in a different way.
Better to have a voice than no voice at all. Yeah. And for the benefit of people who are new to the symphonies, sometimes what we hear is often the opposite in meaning to what...
There's been composers of 20th century, you know, starting from Mahler, actually. When you're listening to the symphonies, quite often... It's extremely, I would say, celebrating music, which in fact covers a disaster behind it. And then you find this disaster much later. You find this terror later on. And the opposite, quite a sad music, but transfigurated.
Symphony number 8, the second in what was to have been, or one might consider, a war trilogy, is a profoundly satisfying piece, I think. One of the pieces that's most celebrated in Shostakovich's output by, you know, musicologists and listeners alike. One of the remarkable features, I think, about it, and so often with Shostakovich, is how so much is built from so little. And the three notes which make up these great climaxes in it, which together are a dissonance, separately are the kind of fabric of the piece.
It's great. I think it's also one of the greatest of his heritage.
Yes.
First of all, that when he had written that, he'd been very brave. Because the whole country and the composers have tried to write the music which is to the victory, which encouraged the people to work more and give them a feeling. In 1943, you know, the war wasn't decided yet. And to give a feeling that we are working hard, we getting the victory, we going in the right direction, and everyone been just a little bit American fighting spirit. Well, he had written, in fact, the truth about what is not in front, but what is behind. So what's the true heroic saga about the people of Russia? What is a true drama there? And that's why the 8th later on being... kind of scrapped out from the repertoire in all the tensions. It's totally opposite to all what has been around him. He had written that in Ivanovka, in this little village where he has been in Korea. In fact, he had written it mainly in a chicken house, because it's been the only place. There have been so many people in this little village, and there have been the only place where he could sit with his piano. The chicken been already eaten years ago. But there's been his unique little place.
It's in five movements, the piece, but it's the relationship between the movements
it's
that make it so
overwhelming. It's all tied together, yeah, 3, 4, 5 especially.
Yeah.
And I would say 7th is more about this global vision of war, So it's like, you know, the masses of people moving here or there and dying, fighting, suffering, celebrating, all what's possible. Eighth, it's a story of the single person suffering and really fighting and struggling with the circumstances, but doing for the best.
He's so uncompromising, it's so direct. I think the thing about his music generally, and it's true of certainly the inner movements, the Eighth, mm-hmm. is that it is so immediate. There's nowhere to hide.
Mm-hmm.
He writes these very militaristic scherzos very well, again with tremendous use of percussion and trumpets.
Mm-hmm.
And the second of the scherzos here, which conveys this mindless force on this ostinato,
mm-hmm.
repeater rhythm, is amazing, isn't it? It's a real force of nature.
That's another picture of this dehumiliation.
Mm.
You know, you really can clearly see the bombs falling out with these glissandos.
Yes.
And all the explosions,
yes.
And all kind of things. But where it leads to,
mm.
it leads to the human personal tragedy. So you have all this, I don't know, the tank battalion slowly and surely arriving and crushing everything, nature and whatever. But then where it leads to the personal tragedy with the same theme as in the beginning.
Yes.
And then this cry of the English horn, which is also related with Mahler in
yes.
a way.
Do you think that this great fourth movement, Passacaglia,
mm-hmm.
is a real slow movement, or do you think it's more of an introduction to the last movement, because they're played without a break?
At the beginning of Passacaglia, after this huge climax, just before, it's the same picture of the burnt brains. It's a feeling of just ash, flying slowly and surely on air, and just gradually goes down. And throughout the first three, I think, variations of Passacaglia, it's this feeling of empty landscape. The voices slowly starts to allude, but they'd still be very, very dead landscape in a way. But then you can see clearly how the nature of the human spirit starts to grow up, so it's basically, you know, quite Hollywoodian. You can see the first grass just growing up,
yes.
throughout this landscape.
The symphony does end with some kind of
statement.
Yes, and it's ambiguous, as so often in Shostakovich. You know, there's a bit of resignation there. It's very beautiful in some ways.
I think it's the first time in his symphonies when he found this ending, first of all. Because fourth is also quite silent, but in another way it's very dramatic and tragic. The Eighth is the first time when he declared this idea that whatever happens with me, whatever happens with the country due to oppression of the Stalin, Lenin, Nazis, all different forces and all tragedies which happened in Soviet and Russia in 20th century. The human spirit will survive.
Mm.
He really had this belief in the humans. And that's the first time when he declares that everything might be well.
Yes.
And later in the symphonies,
more question mark.
No, I wouldn't say the question mark. I would say it's a three dots by that.
Okay. Yeah.
It, at least in this symphony.